As nurses, we know a lot about our patients. We usually monitor the effects of the antimicrobials. Please get engaged. Know your antimicrobials. Know the rationale. Monitor for any side effects and monitor for the overall effectiveness. You don't need to have all the answers, but what you could really play a huge role of, you could be that prompter for the conversation.
Hi, I'm Christiana, and I'm a nurse at the bedside. Thanks for joining me. You know what I've noticed recently? I find myself putting on PPE to go in a room for no other reason than just force of habit. There's no sign, there's no clinical indication, just, you know, see a gown, put it on. And it used to be the opposite. I would forget. So I wondered, like, is it just me? So I asked around, and no, I am not the only one. Other people are habitually putting on their PPE too, which makes me wonder, what is that about? You know, what's the story there? Part of it obviously is COVID. That was just a ton of suiting up, but we're seeing less. And I don't think that that is the whole story. One of the units I work on has been in a VRE outbreak for months. It is not a secret that we're seeing more and more resistant bugs. It's in the news, you know. We see more R's on the sensitivity reports than S's sometimes. So I kind of surmise that maybe putting on the PPE is a result of the increasing prevalence of resistant bugs around me and my body's taking note. I mean, some people don't really seem to worry about it. I remember that was me a number of years ago. We joke about being okay with being colonized because it would ensure us a private room if we ever had to be admitted. But I don't make that joke anymore. One of my family members had a skin infection from MRSA recently, and I couldn't help wondering, you know, did I bring that home? I'm also noticing that more patients and their families are asking questions too. And of course, because we're, you know, often the first ones to tell them that we're switching antibiotics or you need to move rooms or you're going to be isolated, they're asking me the questions. And they are good. They're good questions. They're hard to answer. They want to know why. How did this happen? What does this mean for my health, my treatment, in the future for their family and friends that they live with? These are tough questions with complicated and incomplete answers, right? So how do we respond? You know, we can hand them a pamphlet. We can refer to infection control, who are overwhelmingly busy. And certainly part of the role is just to help people explore their questions, you know, help them find the language, clarify. What are you really asking and why? But these questions and conversations I've had over the years, combined with, you know, this felt experience of increased rates of resistance, it inspired some questions of my own. What is the story with antimicrobial resistance? What does the fact that we're seeing more of it mean on the level of society, but also for the person in front of us, for the future, for me and my family? What can be and is being done about it? And given that we as nurses use antimicrobials literally all the time, what does this mean for how we practice? Because when we, you know, when I'm giving the antibiotics, I want them to work. I want them to do their magic. That's what we want, right? The wound heals, the pain improves, the hemodynamics stabilize. This is what we've grown accustomed to, and this is how we want it to remain. These medicines that we use so routinely, we take them for granted, forgetting that they are, in fact, a miracle, you know, until those rare times when they don't work and we are reminded of what is at stake. To help answer these and other questions, I spoke with a nurse named Linda Yorgoni. Now, our conversation actually took place many months ago. So in a few places where new data has since become available, I have inserted corrections. Any errors that resulted from the delay belong to me alone. I found the information she shared has helped to inform and change the way that I practice around antibiotic use, how I help educate patients and families. I hope you find the same. And now we welcome Linda Iorgoni.
Hi, everyone. My name is Linda Iorgoni. I am a registered nurse by background, and I am currently the clinical nurse leader at Antimicrobial Stewardship Program for both Sinai Health System and University Health Network. You know, one of the things that I appreciate about this role is that it is very novice, and I am probably the only nurse in Canada that does this, a nurse that's only task is to design interventions and do nursing research related to antimicrobial stewardship and antimicrobial resistance. And I thought that this would provide some insight when we speak about the evidence related to nursing and antimicrobial stewardship.
Very cool. What I've found with doing some reading is that there's quite a lot of clunky terminology to work through, like antimicrobial resistance. So why that term in particular, and what does it mean?
So we usually refer to antimicrobial resistance because this encompasses antibiotics, antivirals, and antifungus medication. So in definition, if we think about antimicrobial resistance, we think about an evolutionary process, and it usually occurs when you have a microorganism, like either a bacteria, a virus, or a fungus, that evolves over time and gains resistance to antimicrobials that were previously effective. And when we think about this statement, this is very concerning. Specifically, if we go back and think a little bit about the modern medicine that we practice and enjoy today, if you think about, you know, major advances in modern medicine, such as transplantation, C-sections, all the surgeries that we do today, they all depend on effective antimicrobial therapy or even chemotherapy. You cannot really give chemotherapy without you having an effective antimicrobial, because if down the road your patient has an infection and if you have high rates of resistance, you might not be able to treat the infections. Therefore, you end up with a negative outcomes, regardless if the chemotherapy is effective or not. So when we think about antimicrobial resistance, we always think as a big threat. It's seen as a global threat, and it's a threat that, you know, not only clinicians are worried about, but the public in general.
When you describe it that way, it really rings true to me, you know, both in my time in surgery, as you mentioned, and when I'm working recently in nephrology. Like, there is no dialysis without antimicrobials, right? Line infections are totally ubiquitous. We use antimicrobials routinely, even prophylactically. So yeah, that helps make the nature of the threat, as you say, seem more real in a way.
When I used to speak probably 5 years ago, I used to try to paint a picture. And I used to say, think if you had something as simple as a scratch, unfortunately, you end up having a multi-drug resistant organism that crosses your skin barrier. You end up with an infection. And unfortunately, because the pathogen is a multi-drug resistant, we do not have an effective antimicrobial to treat it, and then your patients unfortunately end up dying. So how would you feel about this? And this is what I was trying to imagine if we lived in the world today where we would not be able to do transplant, where we would not be able to do chemotherapy, or we would not be able to perform, you know, simple surgeries such as appendix removals or C-section. How would that world look like? And now I think a little bit back, and we actually have a perfect view of what a world that has high resistant rates or a world with antimicrobial resistance look like. It's exactly what we're living right now, a pandemic. Think about the times that we're living right now. What is the result of having this pathogen that we cannot treat effectively? We're losing lives, and then we also are, as a society, being paralyzed because we cannot function.
That is a really good example. I remember early in the pandemic working with a number of people with COVID pneumonia, some of whom, you know, died, others just a really tough course. The relief when I treated a patient for good old bacterial pneumonia, you know, give the medicine, they get better. So yeah, a pandemic of resistance, very bad, very bad. And I think as nurses, we all understand the strategies associated, obviously, with not passing resistant bugs around the hospital. Those strategies are heavily aimed at nurses, and they're really integrated into our behaviors, right? Passing the bugs around, not helpful. So we are very actively engaged in their implementation. Hand washing, PPE, screening, all of it. But beyond like stopping resistant bugs from spreading around, what else can be done to stop resistance from actually developing?
Unfortunately, we cannot stop this. But what we can do is we can slow the emergence of antimicrobial resistance. And unfortunately, we haven't had new antimicrobials in the pipeline, but I am a positive thinker, and I believe that our scientists will develop new antimicrobials that would affect the antimicrobial resistance, but they need time. So we know from our data that an overuse of antimicrobials or antibiotics in both humans, livestock, and agriculture accelerates the rates of antimicrobial resistance. We do not live in a bubble. So if you overuse the antimicrobials in the livestock, it's going to affect the emergence of resistance in the microorganisms. And again, these microorganisms do not just live or affect the livestock. It also affects human beings. So we're all interconnected. If you're overusing your antimicrobials in one area, so in livestock or in the humans, we all are interrelated and we'll see a global effect. This is an evolutionary process, you know, like everything else, bacteria evolves as well. So this is where we could do something about it. And this is where we could put our efforts to use them only when needed and if necessary, not just in case, not just to make sure, and not just because a patient comes and asks and demands an antimicrobial.
Since speaking with Linda, this line, "We are all interconnected," it continues to ring in my mind. Especially since reading the wonderful book by Ed Yong called We Contain Multitudes, I highly recommend it. Our bodies, which we think of as our own, you know, with boundaries that separate us from the rest of the world, but actually, we are teeming with microorganisms. We contain more microbes than there are cells of our own bodies. We are truly an ecosystem unto ourselves. And the same is obviously true of animals. In 2020, 1.3 million kilograms of antimicrobials were sold in Canada, the vast majority for use in animals, in industrialized meat production, which works out to be about double the amount of antimicrobials used per biomass when we compare livestock and humans, not including fish. And just as resistance can develop within the system that is a body, so too can resistance develop within larger natural ecosystems. And microbes, of course, are not just incidental here, and the vast majority are not pathogenic. They play integral roles in our functioning and the functioning of the world around us that we barely understand. And so, the World Health Organization advocates a One Health approach to slowing AMR. Animals, plants, humans, the environment. Think how many microbes live in water, in soil, which means that pollution from manufacturing, sewage, agricultural runoff, etc. When this is contaminated with antimicrobials and they're released into the environment, it can drive resistance in the microbes within natural systems with unknown effects. And how many of our antibiotics themselves are derived from naturally occurring microbes found within our environment? So the threats to our planet, climate change, pollution, biodiversity loss, these not only drive resistance, but they degrade the natural spaces that may contain the next breakthrough in antimicrobial therapies. Obviously, a very complex problem. The UN has designated AMR as a top 10 threat to human health and sustainability, which, you know, at this point is a pretty competitive list. So I asked Linda what led to that designation, and she referenced a series of reports released from 2014 to 2016 by a group led by UK economist Jim O'Neill.
Basically, the big highlights were that if we do not have any effective measures, or if we do not take effective measures against antimicrobial resistance, by 2050, we will see about 50 million deaths that they are attributed to antimicrobial resistance. And we will see a worldwide cost of $100 trillion US dollars. And when I used to, you know, show my colleagues this graph, and they'll say, yeah, Linda, I understand, but this is worldwide. This got nothing to do with Canada. Like, it doesn't, like, how does this really affect us? I live in Canada. Maybe this speaks about the third world countries. Like, what does this mean to Canada? Then in 2019, the Council of Canadian Academy released a report that spoke about specifically in Canada, if we do not have effective measures, by 2050, we will see at least 13,700 lives lost to as a result of antimicrobial resistance, and we will most likely see about $7.6 billion in the healthcare cost. And what I want to point out, these reports came before the pandemic. And as we know, this pandemic has changed the curve of a lot of moving parts. And I'm sure, like, we still are collecting data, but we will see that there will be differences in the resistant patterns or in the emergence of resistance because of the pandemic, because of the fact that we have an infection that we can control. We used antimicrobials, and we also will see different numbers, which I'm estimating that they will be higher as it speaks to the overall cost in Canada.
The pandemic has also highlighted that the burden of infectious disease is not borne equally. Between countries or within them, but those who face the most structural vulnerability across so many dimensions, who have the least, will be those most impacted. So it's an equity issue and it's a global issue.
What this pandemic has brought into light is the fact that we do not live in bubbles. And infectious disease that affect one nation can easily become an issue to all nations. And that has also highlighted even more now than ever the importance of having infectious disease physicians, nurses, pharmacists, that they could actually address this huge public health issue that we're living right now.
This is the point where I find the enormity and complexity of the issues, they can just feel overwhelming, right? Like, yes, nurses have a role in public health for sure. Water quality, pollution, equity, planetary health, sustainable food systems, these are all spheres that impact the health of our communities. We have a front row seat to what they're doing in the lives of people, and thus we have a role there, one that admittedly as a profession we have yet to fully inhabit. But in my day-to-day work as a bedside nurse, it's on the level of the individual and their family. And it's great to have all that background information to know, you know, where we fit within the broader picture. But the massive costs, deaths, the numbers are just so big. It can feel almost paralyzing. Like, how do we impact that, right? So it's those personal stories that bring an issue home sometimes. So Linda, have you had an experience with AMR that you'd want to share?
One of the reasons why I choose to become a nurse and why I choose to go into the healthcare was to help people to get better, not to see people die. I spent quite a lot of time in cardiovascular surgeries as a bedside nurse, which I absolutely enjoyed. And one of the biggest drivers to do my job was to make sure that people get the treatment that they required, go home, and they lived a long and healthy life. But, you know, I did have a patient that came in for a triple bypass surgery, which we are very well known at Toronto General to do with very good outcomes. Very young gentleman. Everything was supposed to go great. He was supposed to recover within 6 to 7 days and, you know, go home and go back to his normal life. And unfortunately, he ended up having a multi-drug resistant sternal wound infection. And despite of the efforts of the whole cardiac team, the nurse practitioners, the infectious disease physicians, the surgeon, we ended up losing that patient, even though multiple times we did wound debridement. We sent multiple cultures. We tried to, you know, the antimicrobials available. And unfortunately, our patient passed away.
Oh, that is so sad. I can actually relate. I remember a patient, again, young, came in for something relatively routine. A lot of risk factors for infection. Ended up picking up a bug in hospital. And after, you know, rounds of treatment, but each time, after a few days, the bugs would just come roaring back in new places more and more. And then eventually the person died and it was Oh, it was so difficult for the family, for everybody. And when I see the sensitivity reports coming back with long lists of R's, I remember that person and that experience. And it's not just deaths either, right? Like infected wounds, the debridements, as you mentioned, with really tough recoveries, their associated costs in terms of time, role, function, and of course, financial. These are not small things. So what are some of the trends in resistance, you know, that are most worrisome?
So there is top pathogens that the World Health Organization has identified. MRSA, VRE problem, CRE a huge issue, ESBL producing organisms are a huge issue. But again, there is always new pathogen, gonorrhea becoming one of them, like a huge issue with resistance patterns. And I wouldn't be surprised if we again see Acinetobacter that all of a sudden is resistive to all the treatments that we have on the shelves right now.
Right. I think most of us are probably pretty familiar with these, but of course, in the news recently has been Candida auris, also TB and HIV with resistant strains emerging. But Acinetobacter, I had to look up. I think it's often reported as A. baumannii, one of the more common ones that I have seen that. It's a soil bacteria. It persists on surfaces. Very bad news for us. Usually hospital-acquired infection, which impacts people who are already really quite sick. So resistance here is very bad news. Now, one of the questions I have, I've seen vaccines listed as a way to counter the emergence of resistance, but we don't vaccinate for bacterial infections. So can you just describe the relationship there?
Well, going back to the old saying that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, it's self-explanatory. If we have our population vaccinated and immunized, we will most likely see less infections or no infections. If you do not have infections, then there is no need to treat. We know from the evidence we have antimicrobials that are used appropriately and inappropriately. If you're not treating, then you're minimizing both the appropriate and inappropriate antimicrobials. This is when we also think about population health. Vaccination, most likely you'll end up with no infections, so you'll have a healthier population. So this is the rationale or the train of thought when we think about the role of vaccines as one of the strategies to tackle AMR.
Ah, thank you. Yeah, that is clarifying. Now, you described your role as being a nurse in antimicrobial stewardship. What exactly is that? And how is that differentiated from IPAC?
Antimicrobial stewardship and IPAC, or infection prevention and control, are two different things. They work together, but their mandate is different. When we look about antimicrobial stewardship, their mandate is to maximize antimicrobial therapy and to ensure that antimicrobials are prescribed and used when needed and only if needed. You can have a lot of, you know, ideas, but you do need a coordinated approach. In a lot of acute care hospitals are now mandated to have an antimicrobial stewardship program with collaboration of infection prevention and control to be able to put strategies in place that could somehow tackle issues related to antimicrobial resistance. Looking back at the history, for decades, at least for three good decades, you would see a director, a medical director, a physician with expertise in infectious disease, a pharmacist with a wealth of drug expertise and infectious disease training. You might see a technical analyst, and having a technical analyst in the program is imperative because this is how you could actually pull the data so that you can evaluate and target your approach driven by the data and the evidence that's been collected. And then most likely you would have never seen a nurse. And that made total sense at the time. When we looked at who generated this evidence, it was all the pharmacists and the physicians. And as the programs were designing interventions, looking more broader, you came into the realization that, wait a minute, we have nurses. They are the largest healthcare professions. They are with the patients 24/7. So it makes perfect sense for nurses to be involved and engaged in an antimicrobial stewardship. I think in 2017, the American Nurses Association delivered a white paper, and this was probably the first document that put a stamp on the inquiry, are nurses needed or not? And it was very clear that a lot of practices that nurses do every day are completely aligned with antimicrobial stewardship, and they are perfectly positioned to be engaged and involved. But how? And what kind of strategies could we put in place to support our nursing colleagues or to engage our nursing colleagues to play a role in antimicrobial stewardship? And Dr. Andrew Morris, who is our medical director, he is an innovator, and he looked at that we need a nurse in our program to be able to speak the nursing language, to be able to translate the intervention into the nursing practice, and they need to be involved and engaged, and they can actually have an effect. And this is how my role was created.
Oh, I like how you put that. You know, after three decades, wait a minute, we have nurses. It really reminds me of something I learned from Quinn Grundy, who's a nurse researcher I interviewed back in season one. She describes the as-if world of nursing, an idea that she credits to her time working with her PhD supervisor, Ruth Malone, a researcher in California. And after learning about this idea, honestly, you're just going to see it everywhere. It crops up all the time. So in the as-if world of nursing, it is as if nurses just follow orders and don't have active roles in decision-making, especially related to diagnosis and treatment, that those decisions belong to other disciplines. We may provide the data, but it's, you know, the real decision-making belongs elsewhere, which, you know, from our own experience and from piles of evidence is simply not true. Much of the decision-making in healthcare around diagnosis and treatment, including prescribing, is a complex and dynamic process that relies on distributed responsibility and good communication. And that includes nurses.
One of the things that I'm very proud of, we actually had an article that was published in the BMJ that provided a guidance. How can you start and what is the first step when it comes to engaging nurses in antimicrobial stewardship initiatives? It supports, you know, the interprofessional communications when we all speak the same language, when we all speak the same terminology. And we know from evidence that if your report is unstructured and it changes from one person to another, data pieces are omitted. So basically, important pieces of information are harder to be processed because you have a team now that needs to make a decision and needs to put a plan of care in place, but the information is basically all over the place. In a very simplistic way, we ask nurses to report infection, quote unquote, as a system. So during your bedside rounds, you know, nurses would present in a head-to-toe approach the patient's data. As nurses, when we give a report for our patient, we talk systems. So we usually say neuro, resp, CV, GI, GU. Then we go back to infection. And then we ask nurses to say, verbalize what kind of antimicrobials your patient is receiving, what is the rationale, why, what is the white count, what is the temperature, and if you have any data related to the infection that we're treating, please put it in this particular system so that this report can be coherent versus having a report where temperature is being reported with a CV, then you have antibiotics with the lines, then you have the white count with the labs, and there were pieces of data all over the report that sometimes from the human behavior's perspective, it is harder for you to put them all together. So you are prompting that I have an infection, I have antimicrobials on board, this is the infection findings from my assessment as a nurse, and you as a team now, we will all discuss together this very important part of the patient care. And this ended up being a successful intervention.
This study was carried out within a critical care environment with formalized interprofessional rounds, but the basic concept can be applied anywhere, whether it be during handover or when we're communicating a change in patient status. And given the level of complexity of the patients we care for these days and the scarcity of time and attention, organizing our communication is so important. Now, from here on, we're going to look more closely at the role that nurses play within that fuzzy area between appropriate and inappropriate use, otherwise known as antimicrobial stewardship. But of course, we don't navigate this zone alone. Thankfully, we are part of a team that includes pharmacists, And covering today to lend her expertise is Clarissa Chung. Hi, Clarissa.
Hi, I'm Clarissa Chung. I'm a staff pharmacist on general surgery at Mount Sinai Hospital. I also work on some corporate projects, so I split my time 50-50 between the two areas.
So, Clarissa, communication, so important around treatment choices. How do you see your role there?
As you are aware, in our teaching hospital, we talk to different staff members, different residents, different fellows. So you may have talked to somebody yesterday about Mr. J, and then today it's another person you're talking to. So it's always good to catch them up to speed. And because they change rotations, it could have been they just started day one and they had no idea what Mr. J's, you know, antimicrobial history has been, you know, while they're in the hospital. So it's always good to start off with something kind of like a summary.
And that is why we love pharmacists. So let's imagine we have a patient who we suspect has an infection. What kind of data are we going to consider to guide treatment?
Different things we need to consider when starting empiric therapy for a patient. It was an infection that was acquired in hospital, or did they come in from the community with the infection? For example, if it was somebody who came in like on medicine, they come in with pneumonia, right? So then we would treat them for a very short course of like 3 days, versus if they acquired it sometime during their hospital stay, then they may need a longer course, like 7 days. If they're coming from community, we know certain bugs that are common in the community, right? So we would use antibiotics that target those bugs. But when you're in the hospital for, say, more than a week, then we're concerned about other bugs like Pseudomonas, ESBL, like the more resistant bugs, because now the patient has been in the hospital, right? As you stay longer, like week by week, then you may be more concerned about like more and more resistant bugs. And also depending on what unit you've been in, is the patient, you know, mainly in ICU? Are they on surgery? Are they on medicine? Are they post-op? Are they just coming in from home? You know, are they septic? Are they presenting septic right now? You know, do they have a fever? Are their white blood cell elevated, lactic acid elevated, all of that, you know, tachycardic, hypotensive. Then, of course, we're going to do all our cultures. You know, you start something like on our patient population specifically, like if we're worried about an intra-abdominal source and they've been in the hospital less than a week, then, you know, a lot of times we could just do ceftriaxone flagyl. But if they appear really more septic, then we may need to broaden the antibiotics. Like we may need to go for piperacillin, for example. And if they're really, really like they've been in the hospital for several weeks now and they've had some post-op complications and we're really concerned about other bugs, then we may have to go even more broad and do meropenem right away. Sometimes if they're presenting, you know, they've been in the hospital a few weeks, they've been on TPN for a few weeks, then they may even need fluconazole or something added on there until we get those sensitivities back. Physicians will probably ask the patient, you know, have they had any like recent travel history, recent animal exposure? Also, if they've had any past culture sensitivities, maybe the patients, they've had Cipro so many times that they're actually resistant to it, no matter. Or if they came from another country, then we can look at the resistant map on Google to see what is endemic to this country. What are their resistant patterns? Maybe we shouldn't give this type of antibiotic, even though we would give it first line in Canada. And then as soon as we get the sensitivities back, we'll need to step down because we don't want to increase the risk of resistance to these antibiotics, right? If we don't necessarily need such broad coverage.
And one thing that I also teach my colleagues, a pearl that was taught to me by a lovely microbiologist, and it stuck with me for the rest of my career. If you're doing any cultures, if you want to do right by your patient, take your time and perform this procedure based on the best practice guidelines. If you take shortcuts, if you do not clean the sites correctly, you end up with cultures that could grow something that could potentially be a contaminant, which leaves both the patient and the clinician like kind of in a limbo as to what to do. And yes, we are better at recognizing what our organisms could potentially be contaminants. But remember, it's never 100% perfect that we know it's a contaminant because that clinician wasn't there when these cultures were drawn.
Yeah, I see there's a lot of nursing judgment in there. monitoring response to treatment, especially in those first hours, first doses. Like, are they improving? Are they getting worse? And of course, withdrawing the cultures. Yep, correct techniques. Did we decontaminate the site, the equipment, our hands, get the timing right? Choosing the sources, that's a huge role for nurses. Understanding the rationale, like why are we culturing that particular place? Get enough blood so that our results are meaningful, which is realistically, that's often quite difficult on a very sick patient, but it is important so that we can target the treatment. Another place nurses play a big role is obviously in the selection of route. That's kind of our domain. Because of course, different routes have different risks and benefits. And sometimes the routes are unconventional, like antimicrobials to soak dressings or suspensions that need to be introduced to a rectal stump or into a fistula. Like, you kind of have to get creative sometimes. Or just the regular challenge of maintaining IV access long term, or challenges with swallowing. There's quite a bit of literature around nurses driving safety around route selection, and lots of factors to consider related to route, and they're not trivial. You know, they impact cost, adherence, and the ultimate safety and success of treatment. Again, we are not alone. This is a collaborative process. So Clarissa, as a pharmacist, what do you consider when you're making decisions related to route?
So it depends on, you know, what the infection is. Do we need to treat it IV for a certain duration? So a good example is if a patient develops Staph aureus bacteremia, we have to treat it for 2 weeks of IV antibiotic. We can't step down even if the patient can tolerate it, because this type of bug we know needs to have IV antibiotics for the entire duration. However, other things like patients with UTIs and they're treated with oral antibiotics, like for those ones, if there's no absorption issue, there's no oral intake issue, the bioavailability is really good for those types of antibiotics. You know, maybe for the first couple of days when we, you know, they're just presenting septic and we don't know, is it a urinary source? Is it a blood source? Is it an intra-abdominal source? We can give it like IV for like the couple of days. And then once we have the sensitivities back, tells us that a certain antibiotic can be given orally and it works well, then we can step them down.
Now, that's something that we often hear, right? Stepping down, and not just from IV to PO, but actually stepping down the antibiotic itself, changing it from a broad to more narrow coverage. Can you describe what you mean by that and why we do it?
Broad antibiotics, such as like piptazo and meropenem, they covered many different spectrum of bugs. So they will cover gram-positive, gram-negative, anaerobic, maybe some atypical bugs, versus something that's more narrow like ceftriaxone flagyl. Ceftriaxone is usually used for gram-negative bugs, and flagyl is more for anaerobic coverage. For our intra-abdominal infections, for example, you may not need gram-positive coverage because that's not where we're concerned about where the infection is. In the past decade, we've definitely worked harder on stepping down because we know that the resistant pattern keeps changing.
So understanding the indications for use of broad versus narrow antibiotics seems to be quite an important element to appropriate use. Now, I am obviously not a microbiologist, and this is very complicated, but I'm going to do my best here. Each drug has a different way that it works, or mechanism of action to kill the bugs, and a broader antibiotic has a mechanism that is effective to kill a wider variety of types of bugs. One that is more narrow has a target that is isolated to a smaller selection, a subset of the bugs. So what does this mean for resistance? Well, we need to consider how the bugs resist the drugs. They can do this in a variety of ways. Stop the drug from entering the cell at all, or pump it out once it gets in there with pumps in the cell wall. They may use enzymes like carbapenemase-producing organisms that degrade or eliminate the drug from inside the cell, or change the target of the antibiotic, that cell membrane protein, which is the thing the antibiotic recognizes so it knows to attack the microbe. All of these adaptations involve new cell processes, and that comes at a cost to the bug, be it a metabolic cost or some function that they lose. But in environments with high levels of antimicrobials, these traits are not costly, they're adaptive. So they have an advantage that they pass down to their little buggy babies that all carry genes that enable resistance. But if they're not exposed, then the bugs with these costly adaptations will not be the most successful survivors. Resistance patterns change. But you know what's really wild? Microbes can share genetic material between them, even between species. And they can pick up genetic material from the environment, like from a bug that died, and not just to resist our drugs, but also our cleaning products, adaptations so they can better survive in the environment, or even that just help them share and better integrate genetic material. Which means that the way we dispose of waste is important, which is why I guess we're always talking about hospital drains, you know, because they're down there like plotting. So we try to use the most targeted drug that is still effective, so the bugs don't evolve resistance to all of our mechanisms. And that is why we need good quality cultures and a team that's oriented towards stepping down therapy. As if that all isn't enough, we have to consider not just the appropriateness of the drug for the microbe, but the appropriateness for the patient as well.
We have to look at the patient's characteristics. You know, is the patient elderly? Does the patient have good renal function? Just because a culture is sensitive to a certain antibiotic, it may not be the best antibiotic in that particular patient. So as a pharmacist, we also have to go and see the age of the patient, look to see what their renal function may be, their liver function may be. Are there any potential drug interactions with this antibiotic if we started it? Every drug has a million different side effects. So of course, you want to tell your patient the most common ones they're going to see. And with antibiotics, we know every antibiotic will have the side effects of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, just because of where the antibiotic is working. Sometimes if there's more specific side effects like photosensitivity, or say with flagyl, we know there's an interaction with alcohol. So we say during the duration while you're taking it, avoid alcohol.
One of the biggest roles that we play as nurses is to educate our public, and going back to the times that we're living right now, educate the public about the infection, about the importance of immunization. Educate your patients about if you're discharging them home with an antimicrobial, what to look for, what are some side effects, what to do if they see those side effects. I mean, very little pieces of information can change the patient's outcome.
Yeah, side effects are challenging. It's really difficult to interpret symptoms, especially in the context of illness, infection, and polypharmacy. Those are difficult. The other thing we're always thinking about with antibiotics and safety is allergy. Now, I understand that allergies are related to stewardship. Can you just explain how that all works?
So, you know, most of you guys lately have been, you know, asked more questions when somebody's labeled with a penicillin allergy, because this affects the patient care. So there is a huge difference when it comes to decision making down the road when you have a patient that you're caring for and is labeled with a penicillin allergy versus if the same patient had more data point inputted and more documentation. We go back to evidence, and we know that patients that have a penicillin allergy documented when alternative antibiotics are used, they have poorer healthcare outcomes. So one of the things as nurses, we are the first most likely person that our patients see when they enter our healthcare system. If an allergy to penicillin or an antibiotic in general is identified, ask a couple of more questions. So when did it happen? What kind of a reaction was it? Was there extra care? Did you have to go to the hospital, or was just a simple rush? Or were you short of breath? Having those explanation and extra data points will support the clinicians to choose the right therapy for the patient.
The most common antibiotic allergy we hear of is penicillin. So if they go, oh, I'm allergic to penicillin, then I'll be like, okay, so do you recall what reaction you had to it? And did you have a rash? Did you have anaphylaxis? Like, can you describe what kind of reaction you've had to this? The second step is then I would say, okay, how long ago did you have this? Have you had this penicillin since you've had that first reaction? A lot of times with penicillin, we do notice that patients grow out of this allergy. They may no longer have a reaction to this. Again, this all has to do with antimicrobial resistance. Because when you look at the sensitivities, a lot of times it still comes back, we still get information about like penicillin and ampicillin and amoxiclav, we still get those sensitivities. So if we can narrow it down to an antibiotic that is still sensitive to it, and we don't have, say, a resistant pattern to that in our area, then we want to still be able to give it to this patient. And sometimes, depending on what antibiotic it is, it may be the best one.
Okay, fine. I will document the allergies. But in all honesty, that is not always my favorite call to receive from pharmacy. But it does help to understand the rationale of why we need to gather that information. Okay, I'll do it. Another area where knowledge is changing quite a lot is related to when to stop antibiotics, because it is not always clear and there's not always good evidence. But I have seen a study referenced in my workplace, a trial called Stop It. So Clarissa, what is the story there?
What they found in the study is that shorter duration of antibiotic is actually better. So if the patient has adequate source control, then we can stop antibiotics 4 days after instead of continuing it indefinitely. In the study specifically, they looked at around 500 patients with complicated intra-abdominal infections. Previously, we would look at 7 to 14 days. So we weren't sure how long to treat it for. This study specifically saw that the outcomes after when they had a fixed duration of antibiotic therapy, meaning that hard stop 4 days after source control, their outcomes were similar to those who had a longer course of antibiotics for approximately 8 days that extended until after the resolution of all these abnormalities. I just think the most important thing is knowing when to start antibiotics and knowing when to stop antibiotics, right? Because again, if someone has very common in our patient population, if they have asymptomatic UTIs, just because there's a culture that came back, the patient is not symptomatic, we don't start it. Because if we start something, then we are contributing to the antimicrobial resistance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Diagnostic stewardship and urine. Now, that is a complicated topic. That's basically an episode unto itself. And maybe I'll make it, Stay tuned, listener. I bet you can't wait. So the querying UTI, without going into huge amounts of detail, why is stewardship so focused on the urine culture?
So the overall aim is to maximize the therapy, to minimize the usage of antimicrobials when they're not needed. And I would just give a very easy, specific example when, all of a sudden the patient spikes a fever. And one of the things that we're very accustomed to do in the clinical setting is, send the pen cultures, send everything. So send urine, send sputum, send blood cultures on both sides. If there is a central catheter, send one. Everything needs to be sent. You as a nurse, you could easily communicate to ask a simple question. Is this really necessary to send a urine culture? This patient has absolutely zero signs and symptoms of urinary tract infection. Do we really need to send this urine culture? And one of the reasons why, and this goes back to a diagnostic stewardship intervention that we did with our GIM units at UHN, and we did see a huge decrease in the amount of urine cultures that were sent. But the rationale behind not sending a copious amount of urine cultures with no signs and symptoms of urinary tract infection is to make sure that we do not see or discover asymptomatic bacteriuria, which is basically a pathogen that has invaded the bladder. However, it's not causing any signs and symptoms. And from the evidence, specifically in the bladder, because it doesn't really work the same in other systems of the body, the evidence has showed that when this is treated with antibiotics, then there is absolutely no benefit to sterilize the bladder. And what might potentially happen, because you use an antimicrobial, and if this particular pathogen ends up causing a urinary tract infection in the future, and if you try to address it with an antibiotic, you'll have a pathogen that is now resistant to an antimicrobial that could potentially be used before. So from the data, treatment of asymptomatic bacteria does not have any benefit at all to the patient. So one way to stop treatment of asymptomatic bacteria is not to identify it. So if you have a patient that is absolutely asymptomatic and spikes a fever, You don't have to run and send a urine culture just in case, just to make sure, because the other ripple effect of that would be treating that asymptomatic bacteriuria with no benefit to the patient and potentially with harm. Remember, antimicrobials or antibiotics are not benign. They're not medicine that, you know, a lot of people think you take and nothing happens. They change your complete microbiome. They change your complete flora. And it takes about 6 months or more for your body to get back, if at all possible, to get back to the original microbiome.
Yeah, I think that patients are now more aware of the side effects of antibiotics, like especially if they've had multiple courses of them. I certainly hear more people talking about the impact on their gut. And figuring out the clinical indication for urine cultures like that, that is a work in progress. And having structures that empower nurses with the knowledge required and just set the expectation that we will discuss the appropriateness of collecting the cultures, that all helps to promote psychological safety. Or maybe they're held in the lab, right? I know at Sinai that's the case, until a convincing case can be made that they should be processed. Because we are all afraid of missing something and harming the patient. But once treatment starts, it's very difficult to withdraw. And these are not straightforward decisions. They are tricky.
Yeah, so when we talk about inappropriate antimicrobial use, and this is very important for me to stress out, this is not done by any means maliciously. Like, we're using these antimicrobials inappropriately because, you know, we're careless. Absolutely not. For example, we have a patient with a respiratory tract infection, and it is very challenging, and sometimes it takes time for you to be able to distinguish, and we're getting better and better with diagnostics, if this is a viral or if this is a bacterial. For example, with pneumonia that has caused as a result of flu, either a flu A or flu B, it takes a little bit of time, even though our rapid tests are much better right now. But it takes time for you to get those diagnostics back to figure out and to say with confidence it's viral or it's bacterial. So your first instinct, you want to get them better, you start empirically with an antibiotic, which is nothing wrong. You're doing right by the patient. And if indeed this infection is a viral and it is not bacterial, unfortunately, this antibiotic that was used was inappropriate. Not that it was maliciously done. It's because we didn't have the data point to make the determination at the time. But again, if you have a flu shot, then this cascade of events, it stopped right at you as an individual not having an infection to begin with.
Ah, yes. It always comes back to prevention, doesn't it? So we have covered a lot here. The distributed, shared nature of decision-making related to diagnosing and treating infection, the importance of good communication, the involvement of nursing every step of the way, even when it's somewhat invisible or when we'd rather not be, allergies, especially in those patients with more complex presentations and multiple underlying health conditions. It is not a simple process, but you know, neither is much of what we do in healthcare. But if we want to have these incredible drugs now and in the future, we do have to wade in at the level of the individual patient in front of us, but also thinking more broadly about the impacts of pollution and consumption on our communities and our planet. So just to close, are there any resources that you would like to point towards, general last words you'd want to share?
I strongly recommend try to know your stewards in your clinical setting, because they're a fabulous resource to nurses and to answer questions that you might have.
As you are aware, we do have that antimicrobialstewardship.com website that has, you know, a whole array of guidelines where I usually refer to first, because it's usually the most up-to-date information. You know, what is the best antibiotic for this infection? What is the typical duration that we should treat for this patient? What are their recommendations for, you know, using IV versus oral antibiotics? So I always look at the guidelines first.
If I have my last words would be, you know, sometimes whenever we hear as nurses, you know, antimicrobial resistance, antimicrobial stewardship, we have a little bit our guards up, and this is so new to me, and this is something extra that I need to learn. I just want to give you guys that confidence that you already do it, and you just need to give it a little bit of structure and give it a name, because you're doing it and you're doing a fabulous job. You know, those small steps becomes huge steps that they actually at the end make a difference.
Well, Thank you, Linda. Thank you, Clarissa. And thank you, listener, for joining us here at The Bedside. This season of At The Bedside is supported by a grant from the Nurse Innovator Award from the RNFU, the Registered Nurses Foundation of Ontario, as well as a Science of Care internship from Sinai Health System in Toronto. Special appreciation, as always, to the nurses of the 14th level at Mount Sinai and to the nurses of 7 Nephrology at St. Joseph's Healthcare in Hamilton. You are all beautiful examples of what nursing can be. I am attempting to evaluate the content of this podcast, so please, if you've listened to an episode or two, follow the link in the show notes to the Google survey and give your feedback. I promise it will only take a minute. And while you're at it, consider subscribing through your podcast player or follow At The Bedside on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. I am so appreciative of your time. I will be back in a couple of weeks. Until then, be well.